morning, all. Judge Evans and I are pleased and privileged to have sitting with us this morning Chief Judge McCuskey, the Central District of Illinois, and we obviously thank him for his willingness to serve and help out.
Thank you.
The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Lewis. Mr. Lapuna.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Frank Lapuma. I represent Vernon Williams. Vernon was both a minor villain in the Northern District of Illinois and a disabled, drug-using misfit on the fringes of society. He was a very easy target. In fact, I would say he was an ideal target for ATF and specifically for undercover agent David Gomez. What occurred in this case, specifically on January 4, 2007, the conduct that gives rise to count three, the gun count, what occurred on that date is shocking because the integrity of ATF's investigation fell so far below the typical standards that we see in the district court in this building.
Is there any explanation for the recording device malfunctioning on that day?
Judge, we have never received information as to why the device or how the device malfunctioned. No.
Wasn't there supposedly tests done?
The agent testified, Your Honor, that he had sent the recording device to an unnamed company.
That he didn't remember when he did it.
Correct. That was part of it. He didn't know when he did it. He kept no reports. He kept no correspondence. There was no name ever given for the company, but he said he sent it there in order to have the device fixed and to have the recording retrieved. The issue that I present for my client in this case deals solely with the count of conviction on count three. We're not contesting the drug conspiracy count on count one. In our humble estimation, there was enough evidence from the meeting on December 18th, 2006 to show that my client had agreed to participate. Certainly don't want to bind the co-appellants on that in that regard. But the issue in the case, trimmed to its essence, is whether evidence can be so thoroughly corrupted or so thoroughly corrupt that it must be viewed as insufficient. And in our brief, we've offered seven real reasons why we feel the evidence was so tainted that this court can consider it to be insufficient. And let's start off with the factual premise. The only evidence that my client knew about Billingsley's gun came from the testimony of Agent Gomez. It's true, Billingsley, at the time of the arrest, minutes later at the storage facility, had a gun. He tossed it under the car. We'd like to remember that he was in that car alone. He wasn't in that car with Lewis or Williams. But there was a gun, and there was a gun present. But whether my client knew of the gun comes down to Gomez's credibility. And the seven reasons we offered, one is that there was just one recording device used, and that's contrary to ATF's policy as well as this particular agent's practice, not only in this investigation where he had used two on the December 18th meeting, but also in many cases he had done on his own. Now, standing alone, is that enough for us to complain? No way. No way. But when you consider it in combination with the following reasons, it does cause us to be suspect of the agent's testimony. Number two is he claimed he did not listen to the recording for 2 weeks, contrary to practice. Number three, as Judge Evans pointed out, he never indicated why the state-of-the-art device that was operable just weeks earlier on the December 18th meeting malfunctioned, and no cause has ever been given for that. He did, importantly in our view, he did not secure the evidence in a storage locker or in an evidence cage. He put it at his desk where it sat for 2 weeks. He doesn't know whether he put it in a desk drawer or whether it was at the side of his desk. Number five, and this is also very important, he did not tell other agents, his supervisor, or even the U.S. Attorney's Office about the malfunctioning device and the failure of and that there was no recording for 2 or 3 weeks. And let me just take this one quick moment to say, We have no complaints about the U.S. Attorney's Office in this case, and this particular Assistant U.S. Attorney, Stephen Kubiatowski, is one of the best in the office, and we don't want to make any remarks or to be construed that we're impugning his integrity. He's stuck with the evidence just like we're stuck with the evidence.
And we.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And in this period of time of two or three weeks that passed, co-case agent Tim Wilson testified in the grand jury. And this was on February 1st, weeks after the January 4th meeting and arrest. And he testified falsely in the grand jury that that meeting had been recorded. Now, what makes this really bizarre is that Wilson, the co-case agent, and Gomez, the co-case agent, have desks that are right next to each other. Their offices in Downers Grove. They're not only partners, but they're close friends. Does it make sense that he would not tell him for to all the way past February 1st, in fact, that the recording, the most important piece of evidence in the case, did not, that malfunctioned?
Now, I would imagine, I haven't read the transcript, that the malfunctioning of that recording device on the crucial day, 4th of January, was it?
Yes, Your Honor.
On that day, that was a major attack point for the defense in closing argument, emphasized up and down, sideways, I would think. You guys are all really top-notch lawyers, so I would suspect that you're hammering and hammering on that point.
Your observation is 100% on point.
The jury verdict that...
And isn't this something that Judge Kendall talks about in her decision in this case, that this was all presented and argued to the jury?
You're right, Chief Judge McCuskey. You're absolutely right. This was presented to the jury, Judge Evans. It was also presented to Judge Kendall at the close of the government's case, the close of all the evidence, as well as in our written Rule 29 and Rule 33 motions. And Judge Kendall did come out and say this was all presented. We believe, Your Honor, that Vernon Williams, as I said at the very beginning of this, is a misfit. He's on the edges of society here. There's very little to empathize with his position, I would propose. And the jury was entitled to rely on Gomez's testimony. But what we're saying here is there was such a taint on that evidence that the jury's verdict, even in the light most favorable, which the court must give, and we recognize that, but you also must consider that the court has said a mere modicum of evidence is not sufficient. There must be more than that. And I will offer some other reasons when my time...
Are we faced with a mere modicum of evidence, or are we faced with some evidence that you feel is, in quantitative sense, substantial, but just poisoned by the various factors that you suggest? I mean, it seems like there's more than a modicum if you put all the factors together. But I appreciate your argument. But is the authority that a modicum is not enough what we're faced with here?
Judge, I would say it's a matter of both. One, I think the poison aspect is present. I certainly do. And I think for that reason alone, perhaps even as a matter of law, count three should be vacated. But really, if we look just at the substance of the evidence itself, it's only Gomez's testimony. And in the way he said it, it conflicts with the surveillance agents, first of all, as to what actually happened in terms of, you know, movement around the cars. But most importantly, he says, and this is his testimony, he asked Billingsley to see the gun, so Billingsley takes it out of his waistband in a dark car and holds it up high enough for everyone in the car to see it. So that gives Vernon Williams knowledge. I just think that testimony is incredible, Judge, in light of all the other reasons in this case. Thank you.
Mr. Fisella?
May it please the Court? Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tim Fischella, and I, along with Damon Sharonis, represent Mr. Lewis. The issues before the Court with regard to Mr. Lewis basically fall into two categories. The first category is the sufficiency of the evidence, and with regard to the 924C count three, we would ask, as we did primarily with our written briefs, to adopt the arguments made by Mr. LaPuma. The other set of issues raised before the Court is whether other crimes evidence was properly admitted at trial. Now, in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence, the jury was instructed on entrapment, and therefore the government was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lewis was ready and willing to commit this offense or had a predisposition to commit it before his first interaction with law enforcement. And we would respectfully suggest that the government did not make this showing at trial. The evidence at trial was basically that Scott Lewis, before he met Rojo, who was an agent of the government working with the ATF, was a stay-at-home father who was taking care of two children. He was also working towards an online degree in business. I believe he was 3 credits shy. He met this man named Rojo sometime in the fall of 2006. And as we heard from Agent Gomez, Rojo, as an informant of the ATF, was allowed to maintain a persona as a drug dealer. But he not only maintained a persona as a drug dealer, he actually was one. This man, Rojo, used cocaine and marijuana. He also had large quantities of it. Rojo also traveled.
Is it your position that Lewis didn't use or deal any way with cocaine until he got contact with Rojas?
Yes, Your Honor. Lewis's first...
That he was just entirely clean. He met this agent informant, and he hooked him on cocaine and got him indebted to him. That's the argument that was made.
And yes, in a way, Your Honor. Mr. Lewis was not completely clean. He admitted to prior drug use of marijuana.
Right.
He admitted that he was using marijuana. The change comes when Rojo introduces cocaine to Mr. Lewis. Mr. Lewis then quickly becomes addicted and then begins using cocaine that Rojo had provided on basically a day-to-day basis for that period of time.
What was the type of drug for which he was convicted on possession in the 90s?
I believe there was a marijuana possession charge that Mr. Lewis was, and he did admit on the stand that he had used marijuana in the past, so he was no stranger to drugs. But in terms of the addictive component, I believe cocaine is different in that way, in that it can become sort of a daily habit.
But one of the things you hang your hat on is this $1,000 debt that supposedly, what, threat to the family, $1,000 debt, collecting the money was part of the impetus to get him involved in this. And $1,000 is not a lot of money, and to this guy, is it?
To Rojo, Your Honor?
Yeah.
I believe $1,000 probably is not enough, but one of the things Rojo had, one of the reasons Rojo was out there, not only under the supervision of the ATF, he was allowed to, as long as he kept bringing informants, which he had to do, he was also receiving a monetary fee from the ATF. Now, the exact amount was not allowed at trial, but we were allowed to get into some testimony, brief questioning, that Rojo was a paid informant. So Rojo had this other objective to trying to get other individuals interested in this robbery, not only to maintain his drug dealing, but to receive payments from the ATF. In addition, the $1,000 debt, I believe Mr. Lewis's testimony that it wasn't just the $1,000 debt that sort of got him into this, but it was the $1,000 debt that got him the threat from Rojo, which got him into it. So Mr. Lewis wasn't willing to risk his life for $1,000. I believe at trial it was sort of characterized that way. But I believe what Mr. Lewis's testimony was that he was willing to risk his life in order to, or allegedly in order to, protect him and his family from what he perceived was a real threat.
But isn't there a video that the jury saw that was presented that observed the manner and demeanor? This guy doesn't look scared at all. Wasn't that presented to the jury?
There was a video from December 15th, Your Honor, and admittedly, Mr. Lewis does look somewhat calm. The Rojo is behind that video in the car with him as well. What we had were prior discussions with Rojo, where Rojo was coaching Lewis about how to act when he met Lokito. Rojo told Lewis that this was going to be like, quote-unquote, like a job interview. You've got to tell this guy that you've done this thing before, that you know how to do this sort of armed robbery, and that you can, that you're willing or that you could commit this crime. It was Lewis's position to had to do it. And, in fact, after that December 15th meeting, Rojo then calls Lewis and tells Lewis, you did an okay job, and I'm paraphrasing, this is not a direct quote, but basically says you did an okay job, but you got to sell it harder next time.
Let me ask you a question about Lewis is tried, and Reiter tried first. Lewis testifies in that trial. Then when Billingsley goes to trial, Lewis, who has this telephone conversation, which if Billingsley can get it in, certainly is going to help him. Why does Lewis invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege at that time?
And is this in Billingsley's trial? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I believe at this point we knew there was going to be an appeal pending, and we did not want to subject Mr. Lewis to any further cross-examination. There may also...
He already testified.
He did, Your Honor, and I believe that was just a strategic move to not place Mr. Lewis on the stand to be cross-examined again. There may be appeals down the road and just counsel's decision to protect Mr. Lewis's rights.
I know you're not Billingsley's lawyer, but that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence if you can get in that telephone conversation that Lewis had with his girlfriend saying that Billingsley, he wasn't really in on this. He didn't know what was going down.
It certainly would have been, Your Honor, for Mr. Billingsley. And again, I would just say that I believe that was a strategic decision in order to maintain Mr. Lewis's rights the best way we knew how. One of the other issues that I think is paramount in terms of the entrapment, and it's one of the factors that courts have looked at in terms of the most important, is whether there were initial requests to engage in criminal activity. And Mr. Lewis's testimony was that before this threat of violence, Mr. Lewis was told the basic details about Lokito from Rojo 5 or 6 times, and that Lewis refused each time. It's not until this the details of this crime infused with the threat to Mr. Lewis and his family that Mr. Lewis finally agrees to meet with Lokito. And I can see I'm out of time unless there's any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schell. Ms. Kimmerling?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Kevin Kimmerling for LaVoice Billingsley. As you heard before, Mr. Billingsley brought a gun to this enterprise, and that was a crime. And we don't contest the Section 922 G1 conviction. What we challenge is the sufficiency of the evidence on counts 1 and 2 and 3. In particular, there was no evidence in the record from which any trier of fact could determine beyond a reasonable doubt Mr. Billingsley joined a drug distribution conspiracy. We bring up three errors.
Well, what was he there for with the gun?
There may have been sufficient evidence that he agreed to commit a robbery, but not every robbery of a stash house is for distribution of drugs.
He doesn't know the amount that is being discussed at any point?
There's evidence in the record that he was told by Mr. Lewis the day before that there would be 15 kilograms of cocaine at the stash house.
That's not a distribution amount?
The stipulation in the record was that 20 kilograms of cocaine would be a distribution amount. There was evidence in the record that Agent Gomez told Mr. Billingsley that there could be 20 kilograms of cocaine at the stash house. The special verdict in the trial, however, found that the amount at issue in this case was a detectable amount, but less than 500 grams of cocaine. Beyond the special verdict, there's also the issue of whether Mr. Billingsley was able to know that 20 kilograms was a distribution amount as opposed to a use amount. Mr. Billingsley hadn't seen the 20 kilograms of cocaine. There was no evidence in the record that Mr. Billingsley had any involvement with distribution of drugs. So the two instances of being told what the amount of drugs were and nodding doesn't indicate that Mr. Billingsley understood that the ultimate objective of this endeavor was to distribute drugs.
Was there any testimony reflecting that there was a discussion that there would be significant sums of money as opposed to just drugs?
There was no evidence that Mr. Billingsley knew that. So there. That's
the point. I mean, in the conversations with Mr. Billingsley, Mr. Cummerling, were there anything that would suggest to him that, at least the possibility that we're talking about a robbery of funds as opposed to drugs?
There is evidence that he was told that this would be an armed robbery and that it would be of a stash house and that there would be drugs there. There is no evidence in the record that he was going to get paid any money. There was no evidence that he was going to get a certain amount
right.
of
well,
drugs.
Well, I thought your point was that the evidence would indicate he was going on a robbery, but he didn't know that it was necessarily to acquire drugs that could be distributed later. So the implication I took was that the possibility is that there were just hordes of money there that he was going to take, but that's why I asked you, is there any indication to support that, or are we just to presume that a stash house would also have money as well as drugs? Is that
or that
to this conspiracy challenge you make,
or that the robbery was for the purpose of acquiring drugs for use or the use of the members of the conspiracy, as opposed to distributing it outside of the conspiracy?
So you would have us believe that Mr. Billingsley might have considered an armed robbery to obtain drugs just to satisfy personal use by those who commit the armed robbery?
Exactly. There's nothing in the actual scheme itself that indicates the sophistication of this would only be worth our time for distributing these drugs. What Mr. Billingsley brought to the endeavor was a car and a gun. There was no discussion with Mr. Billingsley about how we're going to distribute these drugs afterwards. There was no indication that he was dealing with a sophisticated group of people who would only take their time to steal enough drugs to distribute. And it's important to distinguish between what Mr. Williams and Mr. Lewis knew and what Mr. Billingsley knew. The December 18th conversation, where the discussions were of the plans that they were going to do to steal the drugs, where Mr. Lewis and Mr. Williams and B, who is not Mr. Billingsley, discussed selling the drugs afterwards. Mr. Billingsley wasn't there. He hasn't even met these people at that point. The conversations that Mr. Billingsley has takes him to the event on January 4th. It doesn't take him to January 5th and what happens after the drugs are acquired. Moving on to the conversation with Rachel Roberts and Scott Lewis that Mr. Billingsley would have liked to have entered, the evidence that Mr. Billingsley didn't know that this was a robbery of drugs.
What's your best argument that that was a statement against Lewis's penal interest, so it was admissible except hearsay?
When Mr. Lewis says that Billingsley didn't know what was going on, embedded in that statement is, I did know what was going on, and I knew what was going on enough that I can tell you that Mr. Billingsley does not know what's going on. That would be admissible against Mr. Lewis in his trial to say that he understood what was going on enough to say that Mr. Billingsley did not. And because it's probative against him, it is against his penal interests. Beyond that...
Well, the government had no objection to putting in Lewis's statement that he knew what was going on. They were objecting to the part where he exonerates Billingsley. And what in that exoneration... You want us to look at the whole statement and say, generally against penal interest, so anything else that's in there is fair game for the jury to hear.
Because embedded in the statement is both the implication to himself and the exoneration of Mr. Billingsley, yes. I see that my time is up if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kimmerling. Dobiatowski.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Steve Kubitowski, representing the United States. I'll address the arguments as presented by Counsel Siriatim. With respect to Mr. Williams, we would take issue with counsel's suggestion that he was an easy target or a misfit. I believe the record makes clear that he had multiple residential burglaries in his background. He was no stranger to criminal activity. With respect to the recording devices that failed, obviously that was the crux of the trial, as you suggested, Judge Evans. That was what was emphasized in the opening. During the withering cross-examinations of Agent Gomez and Agent Wilson, and that is what was emphasized emphatically during closing arguments. But the jury reached its decision that based on the evidence that the defendants participated in the conspiracy to rob the drug stash house of approximately 15 to 20 kilograms of cocaine. With respect to the 924C argument, which is also reviewed by a sufficiency standard, Mr. LaPuma's argument focuses on actual knowledge of the possession of a firearm by a co-conspirator. However, the law in the circuit is very clear that for purposes of a 924C conviction, that conviction can be held if it is reasonably foreseeable that one of your co-conspirators would bring a firearm to a planned drug activity. And in this case, the conversations on December 18, 2006, which were recorded, made it very clear that Mr. Williams and his co-conspirators, Scott Lewis, needed to bring firearms in order to rush the stash house and subdue the armed occupants, take them by surprise, and, as Mr. Williams pointed out, tie them down, strip them buck naked, and then ransack the place. Based on that conversation alone, it was reasonably foreseeable Mr. Williams that a firearm would be present when that arrest would be executed. And in fact, on January 4th, the day of the arrest, one of Mr. Williams's co-conspirators did bring a gun to that to the meet in order to execute the robbery. And along with that firearm, Mr. Billingsley brought 93 rounds of ammunition. So based on the reasonable foreseeability theory, that alone would be sufficient to uphold the conviction under 924C for all three defendants, independent of any testimony by Agent Gomez. With respect to Mr. Lewis,
let me ask you a question.
Certainly.
Mr. LaPuma, who's a terrific lawyer, gets up here and in effect exonerates you but says this is a terrible investigation by ATF. It looks like the exact same thing that was done in this, what is Corson case back in 09. Same names, everything. This does look like a pretty cheesy sting operation. I imagine you can't go through any rundown inner city area and get thousands of people who will want to stick up a stash house. And I know I read Judge Tinder's opinion in that Corson case, which says, you know, if we were policymakers, we'd question whether or not this is a good use of law enforcement money and energies to ferret out a case like this. And that's what it seems like to me. Now, that doesn't mean that the evidence is not sufficient to support the convictions, but seeing that you were exonerated from any responsibility by a very fine defense lawyer here, but the blame was put on ATF. What do you think about this kind of a rob the stash house investigation?
Well, Your Honor, number one, the Corson case, I believe, was decided after this case had been indicted or shortly thereafter. So certainly the office was not in a position to evaluate this court's opinion regarding the exercise of prosecutorial discretion in this type of case. But number two, this type of case, this type of operation was designed to target individuals who have some type of criminal background, who would be willing to rush what they believe to be a Mexican cartel stash house guarded by armed occupants, possibly with automatic weapons, in order to steal.
This seemed like a pretty Keystone Cops operation that they put together to storm this highly guarded stash house, didn't it? They didn't even have a gun until Billingsley shows up in the last minute of this movie and joins the scene.
But nonetheless, he did show up, Your Honor, and he showed up with a loaded firearm and 93 rounds. Mr. Williams came with two pairs of plastic surgical gloves. They intended, at least that was our view of the evidence, and that's what the jury concluded. They intended to go through with the robbery. Maybe this is an instance where they had more perceived brawn than brains as far as going forward with it, but nonetheless, they thought with the element of surprise that they would be able to subdue armed occupants. And this is not the type of investigation where if you approach normal law-abiding citizens on the street that they're going to jump at. The only type of person that's going to jump at an opportunity like this are individuals such as the defendants in this case,
Lewis,
with lengthy criminal records.
Money to a government informant.
I'm sorry?
The government informant has a stick over Lewis's head, and you owe me $1,000, we're going to...
Well, that was the...
that money, this is the way you can work off your debt.
That was the defendant's story. And
well, I don't know if I believe that. That was the first time he ever sniffed cocaine was when he met Rose. But be that as it may, he got indebted. You agreed to that.
We didn't agree that he was actually in debt to Mr. Rojo. There was no evidence outside of Mr. Lewis's testimony that he was in fact in debt to Mr. Rojo. Our argument was that his theory of entrapment was completely implausible for the reason that Judge McCuskey suggested. Would you risk your life for $1,000 drug debt by rushing a Mexican cartel stash house with armed guards? You had no other access to $1,000. You had no friends or relatives that you can ask, can I have $1,000 because I need to pay off a drug debt? Otherwise, my life is in jeopardy. He never called the police. He never left the area. This is, and during one of the videos on December 15th, 2006, when he's asked by the undercover agent, have you done this type of thing before? He laughed. He chuckled. Yes, I've done this. We've done this type of thing before.
If you believe him, he right. had to act like he was an experienced guy in this sort of thing to sell that to Gomez that he could pull this off.
Certainly. But nonetheless,
just the whole operation. Go ahead, I'm sorry. But it just seems to me that it's just...
I would agree, Your Honor. It, from the government's perspective, the evidence would have been a lot stronger had the recording devices worked. But they didn't, and that's why we had a trial. And the evidence still came in that all three defendants arrived on the evening that robbery was supposed to take place, once they received the call from the undercover agent. They came with a loaded firearm, 93 rounds of ammunition, and plastic surgical gloves.
Why did the government object to letting the jury hear what Lewis told his girlfriend in that recorded conversation?
That was a jailhouse call, Your Honor.
Yeah. So it was a staged call? What did he have to get out of staging a call to show Billingsley didn't know what was going on?
Well, what he said in his conversation to his girlfriend at the MCC over the phone was that I was entrapped. And in that regard, we do not believe that that is an interest so against your penal interest. He couched it, oh, I was entrapped, and Mr. Billingsley did not know what was going on. So, yes, to some extent, Mr. Lewis was saying, I knew what was going on. But then he colors it. He knows at that point, a week after the arrest, what his defense is going to be at trial, namely entrapment. So he specifically uses the word in the recorded conversation, entrapped. He is denying his criminal liability and at the same time exculpating his co-conspirator, LaVoyce Billingsley. So in this particular instance, the district court assumed for purposes of her ruling that Mr. Lewis was unavailable and also assumed did not address the argument regarding penal interest. She assumed it was against penal interest. But she said that the circumstances of that statement were not sufficiently trustworthy to warrant admission. And in that case, that was a reasonable ruling. It was not an abuse of discretion because Mr. Lewis, only a week prior in his post-arrest statement, had stated that he had told Mr. Billingsley about the robbery. He told him that would be 15 to 20 kilograms of cocaine at a stash house, and that Mr. Billingsley agreed to cooperate. And the district court ruled that based on that statement made only a week prior, which was inconsistent with the statement he had made to his girlfriend, that was sufficient to render that statement untrustworthy. We would also add, to bolster the district court's ruling, that we, for the reasons I stated, that Mr. Lewis said he was entrapped, that was not against his penal interest. And just to be clear, because I wasn't sure based on one of your questions, Judge Evans, that statement by Mr. Lewis to his girlfriend suggesting he knew what was going on was never introduced. No portion of that MCC conversation was introduced either by the government or by the defense for the reasons that we stated. We believe that his statement was exculpatory on his end, namely, I was entrapped.
So are you saying if he had not brought up entrapment in that statement, the part of the statement that exonerated Billingsley would have been admissible?
I would have had to review the statement. If it's a party admission, if he implicates himself, we could theoretically introduce that statement against him.
No, you could. I'm talking about Billingsley wants to put that statement in at his trial. Your big argument is, as I understand what you're saying,
under those circumstances,
it's not against his penal interest because he threw in entrapment in there, which is separating himself from criminal liability. I'm saying if you take the entrapment out, was that statement admissible? Could Billingsley put that statement in because it was against Lewis's penal interest?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. The fact that he's trying to exculpate somebody else, and he's inculpating himself, but the fact that he's trying to exculpate somebody else may not necessarily make it a trustworthy statement. I could envision many circumstances where someone would take on the crime, so to speak, acknowledge his or her guilt, and try to exonerate any friends, family members that person could. It would have to be a very fact-intensive situation because I see them as being disjointed.
In his trial, what did Lewis's trial? What did Lewis say Because he testified in his own defense in his trial. What did he say about Billingsley's participation in that?
He was not asked. We did not, if I recall correctly, the government during cross-examination did not ask him anything about Mr. Any statements that he made to Mr. Billingsley or vice versa for fear of Bruton concerns. I'm pretty sure we stayed away from that.
The trials were separated because
yes,
of Bruton.
Yes, exactly. Certainly a review of the record would refresh my recollection regarding that point, but I am pretty confident that we did not go there. With respect to the last defendant, Mr. Billingsley, as far as sufficiency, no evidence of a conspiracy to distribute drugs. Well, obviously, you had the stipulation that 20 kilograms of cocaine is a distribution amount. It is not an amount intended.
What about the argument that anything less than that is just to be used by the co-conspirators personally? Was that argument made to the jury in any way?
That argument wasn't made to the jury. There was no argument that amounts less than 20 kilograms was a distribution amount. The tape-recorded conversations, where Mr. Billingsley admittedly was not present, talked about 20 kilograms of cocaine. In Mr. Billingsley's post-arrest statement, he acknowledged agreeing to participate in a robbery of a stash house for 15 to 20 kilograms of cocaine. Mr. Billingsley was a member of that conspiracy, so even if he did not personally intend to distribute that drugs, he knew, at least the evidence was sufficient to establish that someone in that conspiracy would distribute that cocaine. And in fact, Mr. Williams, as defense counsel acknowledged during argument, Mr. Williams was engaged in the conversation that was recorded in which he discussed not wanting to break it down, but he was going to sell it whole. And that's a co-conspirator statement, which could be, which was admissible as to its truth to Mr. Billingsley. I believe I've covered all the points raised by defense counsel. Unless there are any further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Kubitowski. Mr. Lapuma, had no time, but you had some significant questions from us, so you may have an additional 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Your Honor, I would just comment on some of the questions the court had put forth to Mr. Kubitowski. And most recently, Judge Evans brought up the Corson case, but most recently the court came out in United States versus Blitch on September 3rd with a reversal of a case for juror issues. But that's another case in which Lokito, Agent Gomez, assumed the undercover role and presented this type of scenario to some individuals. And again, the court questioned the policy behind that. And I would follow that with this. Mr. Kubitowski indicated they target people who have criminal histories. Well, Vernon did have a criminal history. It was a minor one. I disagree that it was residential burglary. I might be wrong. I thought it was commercial burglary, but certainly nothing that ever involved violence or guns, as Judge Kendall aptly pointed out. But what Gomez testified to was that ATF targeted professional crews. That's unrebutted, professional crews. By far, this was not a professional crew. They showed up with a gun, Billingsley's gun apparently, that had to be manipulated to fire. Another agent testified to that. Vernon Williams shows up with some plastic gloves, which I don't know the purpose of surgical gloves on his person. But this stash house is supposedly protected by three violent armed cartel members, and we have these yahoos showing up with one gun with 93 bullets of ammunition, which would require a lot of changing of that barrel to fire, and a couple of guys with some plastic gloves, and this was all a fantasy to them. It is a very cheesy operation, and it's one that's susceptible to law enforcement abuse. And in our view, Gomez did abuse his police powers in this instance. And the last thing I would like to say is this. He lied to the jury when he said there was only one recording device available. that was proven later in the trial when another agent testified that he took, another ATF agent, took another recording device and put it in the prisoner transport van to capture their post-arrest statements. So that proved that Gomez lied. The point of that, though, is that recording device, according to ATF, also malfunctioned. These combination of strange occurrences certainly, you know, I don't know how it got past the jury, but we would ask the court, for my client, to vacate count three. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. LaPuma and Mr. Kemmerling, you were appointed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you have the additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing your clients.
Thank you.
All right. The case is taken under advisement.